Transmitiendo desde la Universidad de Yale en Estados Unidos, esto es Procrastinando, un programa de filosofía del derecho con un carácter totalmente informal.
Buenos días, Facultad de Derecho. Buenos días, Universidad Nacional Autónoma de México. Buenos días, México. Buenos días, donde quiera que nos esté escuchando. Buenas tardes, dependiendo del paralelo en que nos estén viendo. Hoy nos encontramos aquí en la Universidad de Yale para entrevistar a uno de los más importantes constitucionalistas norteamericanos, profesor de esta universidad, que es el profesor Owen Fisk. Welcome, Professor Owen Fisk. Thank you for allowing us to interview you.
Thank you.
Well, you have been working a lot of issues in your teaching career and your researching career, and maybe one of the biggest topics you have worked is free speech. I will start by getting from you a definition. What is free speech for you? Does free speech has limited or is unlimited, has to be controlled or not?
Well, I see free speech as a constitutional protection of democracy, that the purpose of protecting free speech is to make sure we have a democratic system of governance. Freedom of speech is designed to produce a debate on issues of national importance that is, in the terms of our Supreme Court, robust, wide open, and uninhibited. And when we have this robust debate on issues of public importance, I believe then we are achieving the purposes of freedom of speech.
This freedom of speech, as I asked you before, has to be limited. I mean, people can go as far as they want in going or reclaiming, claiming from a robust debate. Is has to be unlimited or is limited, this right?
Well, I do believe that freedom of speech necessarily implies some limits on it. I don't think there's any conception of freedom of speech that doesn't have a recognition of some limits. But all those limits have to be examined to see whether they enhance public debate or restrict public debate. And that strikes me as the essential criterion of deciding whether a limitation is acceptable. Sometimes the threat to freedom of speech comes from the state. The policeman arrests someone who is making a speech criticizing the government. But one of the special themes of my work is that that threat to freedom of speech comes not just from the state, but also from private aggregations of power.
In you have wrote a book lately named The Irony of Free Speech. In this book, you claim that there is a conflict of between the First and the 14th Guarantee in the United States. How can we resolve this conflict of norms that you found out?
The first thing we should remember is that the conflict that you're referring to is not just a conflict between the First Amendment and the 14th Amendment, between free speech and the protection of equality. We have to recognize also that there's a conflict within free speech. That is to say, if we give these private aggregations of power unlimited reign, they will not enhance freedom of speech as I understand it, but also act as a censor. They will curb the freedom of speech in the sense that they will limit public debate. And so I don't have a clear formulator to decide which restrictions are legitimate and which ones are illegitimate. But I want to say that it's not just a conflict between the First Amendment and the 14th Amendment, not just between liberty and equality, but the conflict is within the First Amendment, within the guarantee of freedom of speech.
You wrote an essay, a very interesting essay, named Adjudication, early, late in the late 1970s. And in this essay, you said you look adjudication as, let me put it this way, more positive way than the critical studies. You say that adjudication can be good because in this way the judge can help the sure. people. Sure. Do you still feel the same?
Yes. I mean, increasingly in the United States, we have decisions by judges on the Supreme Court, for example, that I think are mistakes. When I say turn to adjudication, I don't guarantee that we'll always be free of errors. But what I was doing, one essay that I wrote called Against Settlement, is comparing what a judge could do as opposed to what would happen if two parties just bargain and negotiate. And my theory is that whatever mistakes the judge makes, the judge will get us closer to what justice is than simply the negotiation or bargaining between the two parties. In the United States, starting in the late 70s and early 80s, there has been increasing emphasis upon something called alternative dispute resolution. And the underlying notion there is that we should stay away from the courts. We should negotiate, mediate, arbitrate, bargain as a way of resolving our disputes. And as you intimated by your question, I say, well, that might help in the resolution of the dispute and produce peace. But the aspiration of law is not peace, but justice. And if we're talking about justice, I see the judge as a public official, a representative of the state, being able to bring us closer to justice than the simple negotiation between the two parties.
In your work, you have been very close to America, to Latin America. You have been in Argentina, have been in Mexico. And I guess I have to ask this question in order to make clear this concept of adjudication. Do you think that the judge can get to understand or interpret the public values? I put it in this way. In the United States, it's a very multicultural state. People from all over the world is here. And how the judge can know these public values, or how can we determine these public values?
Well, I don't purport to speak for Mexico, all of Latin America. And I know some portions of Latin America, like Argentina or Chile, or even before that, Brazil, had a very unfortunate experience that they were ruled by brutal dictatorships. But at this point in history, those countries that I mentioned have returned to a kind of democratic regime, and perhaps not that different than Mexico is today. I don't I mean, lots of people from Latin America think that there's something dysfunctional about their judiciary and not able to articulate these public values. But I don't see anything more dysfunctional in the Latin American judiciary than from the United States judges. When I speak about public values, for example, we talked just a moment ago about free speech. I was talking about understanding what freedom of speech entails in the United States. And that value is enhanced or encapsulated in the Constitution. But I'm sure in Mexico, Argentina, Chile, Brazil, they have constitutions also that are attached to this value, and they're capable of articulating the meaning in much the same way as judges in the United States. I don't think the judges in the United States have a kind of monopoly on the interpretive power that comes from that they have enjoyed over the years.
In your work,
I view judges in the United States as not really people with moral expertise. I mean, they're not different than politicians or high business people in terms of their knowledge of these public values. I think what's distinctive in the United States that gives them the authority to articulate, interpret these public values in the Constitution is that they're limited by a certain procedure. They have to hear all the parties, they have to have trials in open court, they have to announce publicly their decision, they have to give reasons and principles to support the decision, and they have to remain insulated from political agencies. I think that's true of the United States and is a source of authority of the United States, but I think it's also true in Mexico, and I think it's also true in other parts of Latin America. I don't know what's happening at this moment in Ecuador, Venezuela, or Bolivia, but insofar we're talking about Mexico, Argentina, or Chile, I think they have a functioning judiciary that has the same authority as United States judges to elaborate on the meaning of these values.
You are a member of the CELA committee, the Seminario de Latinoamérica de Teoría Constitucional y Política, for several years.
20 years.
Yes. Have you seen progress in the law in America? The law has progressed for good or for bad? Where do you see us in these 20 years?
Well, we've been in existence 20 years. The first meeting was held in the summer of 1995. My first experience, and real experience in Latin America, was in 1985 when I went to Argentina with a small group of other philosophers and lawyers to work on the transition to democracy occurring there. So my perspective dates not just to 1995, but also reaches back even before that to 1985. And I would say that the most remarkable thing to me is that over these 20 years, or over these 30 years, regardless of whether you take 1995, 1985 as your benchmark, I think there's been a remarkable convergence in the methodology and perspective of academic lawyers in the United States at Yale and the lawyers who participate from Mexico or other Latin American countries. It doesn't happen overnight, but I think there is a remarkable convergence about how and what we think about law. I would say the distinguishing factor of American academic law is its critical perspective on the work of the judiciary. I mean, we analyze, we describe, but we always remain a certain distance from it to see if that measures up to justice. We reject any dogmatic conception that this is justice. And I would say that 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 perspective is increasingly manifest in the work of CELA. Some of our people, like Jose Ramon Cosillo, was a member of CELA when he was the dean of ITAM. And there are a great number of lawyers and political scientists from Mexico who are in our group. And I do see a convergence, and not quite the same. You have different starting points. The fact that you're a civil law country, the code induces a certain perspective on law. But I think it's getting closer over these last 20 or 30 years.
I was reading a few weeks ago the latest book of Bruce Ackerman, We the People, number 3.
Right.
In which he talks about the civil rights in the 1960s. And I guess it's a, for me, it will be a very beautiful detail that he dedicated the book for you. And I guess he's right in dedicating to you, because you were a special actor during those times. How do you see the civil rights movements from the 60s to today in America, in the United States? Where do you have to go? Where do you have to move? What do you need to do to transform and go to a very most equal society? Because I remember you wrote a book, A Way Out from the Ghettos, and you were worried about the people, the black colored people. So what has been changing here in the United States, and what's not is changing here?
Well, that's a very good question and a very deep question, and I'm a little unclear about the answer. In November 2008, the United States elected a black man as president of the United States. This was a transcendent event in the history of the United States that began, as you know, with slavery based on race. And my work in the 60s in the Civil Rights Division of the Department of Justice was very much concerned with employment discrimination, school segregation, discrimination in public accommodations, and also with election discrimination, so that blacks were not were completely disenfranchised in some of the states. Now, from that perspective, I couldn't have foreseen that in the year 2008 we would have a black man elected president of the United States. And I think that's a remarkable achievement. I would say, speaking more generally, over the last 40 or 50 years, we have made tremendous progress in creating what I call a black middle class. So you look at, for example, the mayor of New York, who's white, but you look at his cabinet, it's just incredible to find people of color in that cabinet at the level. So I think it's a remarkable achievement what we've accomplished. On the other hand, as you mentioned in this book, A Way Out, I also think that what has happened is not a moment to stop. Although we have created a black middle class, although we've had a president of the United States who is black, we still have what I call the black underclass that still exists and needs our attention. The black underclass consists of people who are black, but also people who are unemployed or live at levels of economic deprivation that makes them still a pariah in American society. And I think, although I want to celebrate the progress, I still, as I do in this book, A Way Out, I'm still deeply concerned about the plight of those who've been left behind. And that is the class of the black underclass.
This class seems to be growing.
This class seems to be growing more entrenched. The inequalities that are we characterize in America also, as they get higher, the blacks unemployed, neighborhoods living in neighborhoods that are still riddled with crime, no manufacturing jobs for any of them. I think it's just getting worse. The other thing, I don't mean to go on indefinitely, but in the 60s, in the early 60s, we were primarily, not exclusively, but primarily focusing on blacks and their exclusion from American society. They were the pariah underclass of our society. And we adopted a lot of strategies to improve their situation. But today, I think the cause of civil rights has many dimensions to it. It's not just concerned with the blacks. Over the years, it's been concerned, growing increasingly concerned with the plight of women, with the, and it's following that, the plight of the LGBT community, gay and lesbian, bisexual and transgender movement, and we've been concerned with those rights. At the same time, we're concerned, increasing concern, with the Hispanic community in the United States. I don't think any of these groups had the disabilities that blacks had in the 60s, but they have plenty of disabilities, and that civil rights today is understood as embracing their interest as well as the black. And at this very moment, I think Americans are becoming increasingly concerned, as they were in the mid-60s, with the poor. This book published by Thomas Piketty, these demonstrations by Occupy Wall Street are calling attention to the growth of tremendous inequalities, economic inequalities in America, which need our attention. So the answer to your question is that I think we've made tremendous progress on the issue of blacks, but a lot has to be done on the issue of the black underclass. And on top of that, I think we need to pay attention to the needs of these other groups, the poor, ethnic minorities, gay, lesbian community, and to the situation of women.
It's good that you point out to the Hispanic community, and I guess I cannot avoid this question for you as a constitutional professor and defender of the civil rights. What is your position, what is your point of view about the migrant kids, the problem of the migrant kids coming to the United States? What should we do with this problem? Because there is an enormous number of kids that are crossing the border. And I was watching the TVs late on, like early this week, and I saw a person from the government that say that these kids were crossing because they told them that they can have better concessions for get the nationality, which is a joke. They don't cross for it. They cross for other reasons. So what is the answer to stop this problem that is growing?
Well, in the 1980s, Texas passed a law which denied children of this is the phrase they use, illegal immigrants from, and who are themselves illegal immigrants, from going to public schools. And in a famous decision by the Supreme Court, in a case called Plyla versus Doe, the Supreme Court said that this was an inappropriate response to these children. And that whatever you do, you can't adopt policies that transform these migrant children into a new pariah class. And I thoroughly agree with that decision and would say that that's the key to understand of what you can do. You can, perhaps you could stop them at the border, but if these children come into the United States, they have should be treated as members of our community and given the full benefits of what it means to be a member of our community. They cannot be denied education, and they shouldn't be denied the opportunity to work, or they shouldn't be denied the benefits that come from the welfare system, like food stamps or health care. They are part of our community, and they should be accepted as members of our community.
Well, to end this interview, which I have enjoyed a lot, what are you working now? What is next in your work? What should we expect?
Well, when I first went to Latin America in 1985 to Argentina, I went down there thinking that we in the United States had a lot to impart to people in Argentina or the rest of Latin America. I thought I was riding on a white horse, bringing our learnings and our achievements. I would say increasingly, but after 2001 and President Bush's declaration of the war on terror, I think the people in Latin America, the other members of CELA, have been holding up a mirror to us and asking whether our law is as noble and as good as we pretend. And starting in 2003 and continuing to this day, I have been focusing on the war on terror that was announced by President Bush and unfortunately continued by President Obama for the last decade. And I, over this 10-year period, 12-year period, continuing to today, I have been mainly examining the counterterrorism policies of the two administrations and try to understand how these policies affect our Constitution. And I've been sort of publishing articles and books that have been very critical of the critical of these policies, not from an international law point, but from our own Constitution, that there's transgressions of certain principles that are sacred to our Constitution that have been trampled over the last decade. We've, you know, imprisoned people without offering them an opportunity for trial. We have used military commissions to try some of them. We have denied some habeas corpus. We have engaged in warrantless wiretapping. And most recently, particularly during Obama's administration, although there are traces before, we have engaged in targeted killing of suspected terrorists. And all of these policies may be justified in terms of pragmatic necessity, but I think they betray certain fundamental constitutional principles of the United States. And that's what I have been working on for the last decade.
By using this answer, many constitutional theorists nowadays in America, in the United States, say that the presidential figure, the institution of the presidency, has too many powers, that they have to control it. Do you feel the same?
I think a lot of people feel that way, and a lot of people criticize the Bush administration on what's called unilateralism. Acting on his own would have the concurrence of Congress or the court. But my feeling is, I don't know. I don't know how profound a criticism that is, because what's remarkable is that Congress has acquiesced in at least the counterterrorism, acquiesced in the policies of the Bush administration and in the Obama administration. Congress has been very tough on President Obama, particularly in areas like health care, tax policy, job creation. But in the area that I know best, namely the counterterrorism, Congress has been very agreeable and acquiescing in this thing. And I feel also that the Supreme Court has been deferring to the president as well. And although there are some decisions that the Supreme Court has made that curb the power of the president, these are exceptions and very limited exercises by the courts. So maybe the president has increased his power, but always with the approval of Congress and the willingness of the Supreme Court to close its eyes to what's happening before.
I must say that I first read your work because Professor Gargarella, he used to talk and write a lot about you. And so much writing about you made me read your work. And as I told you when I knew you, that most of your work, you have work in Spanish, but it's hard to find out. Still, you can try the persons in Mexico City and in America to find about the books you have wrote in Spanish. I don't know if you can tell them about those books so they can find it.
Well, one book that I've written is on my theories of free speech, which has been published in Spanish. One is The Irony of Free Speech. Another one is Free Speech and Social Structure. A third one is called Democracy and Dissent, which was edited by Professor Gargarella. All of these are in Spanish. My work on the one subject that we talked about, namely adjudication and procedure, has been published in Spanish. A publisher in Spain published it, and it's called the Law as Public Reason, and that was published in Spain. It should be available, and it includes most of my articles on adjudication, structural reform, and most recently I published a book based on my work on law and human rights, and that was also published in Spain, and in the English title is The Dictates of Justice, and that deals mainly with the issues of human rights, both in Argentina and the United States. It sort of half is the United States problem and half Argentina.
Well, Professor Fez, it has been a real pleasure to talk with you. I guess that it's hard to understand the civil rights movements without reading your work. It's very valuable. Hopefully the people in America and in Mexico will read it. It has been a pleasure, Professor
Fez. Thank you. Thank you.
Now that's me and how I'm looking out for my little heart. Oh, and how I had you with me. How did it drift this far? Just a little stiff embrace and the life as usual, with our pockets full of something that was beautiful and all the world we knew.
those nights. What's left for all when those